This is an ABC podcast.
We expected for him to be there and to hear the people of the Cook Islands, but he wasn't there. So what's the point in talking to any other minister? He's the head of the country.
Protesters in Rarotonga upset that the Prime Minister did not show up to hear their concerns. Human rights advocates are upset that after two brutal killings in PNG, no arrests have been made.
The problem we have is that there is no consequence for crimes that are being committed. So of course people are going to go around and do all of this because they know that they can do it and get away with it. And that's where our problem is.
And realisation is sinking in for our Pacific communities in the US that deportation is very real.
There's been some reports in Utah, here in California, of ICE officers coming around places of worship, places of employment, as well as outside of schools. For them, it's that realization like, oh, wait, this is for real? This is happening? Yeah, it's happening.
More on those stories shortly, but manuia litsa yau, eke mawe omo and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Before we get into the show, we'd like to give acknowledgement that we come to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and I say whakawe lahi. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, we start in the Cook Islands, where the government has issued an action plan on its new agreement with China. The document's release has been acknowledged by New Zealand, with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs saying it'll study it before commenting. As for the streets of Awarua, they were full of colour and noise yesterday as protesters marched to Parliament House to raise their concerns about a Cook Islands passport and the lack of transparency over the deal with China. Brendan Telfer was there and filed this report from Rarotonga.
Around 300 people gathered outside the House of Parliament to protest the government's recent strategic partnership with China. Tensions also flared over the Cook Islands passport controversy, which was recently scrapped after a public backlash. For the crowd gathered outside Parliament, the issue highlighted lack of consultation, issues of transparency, and suspicion about Chinese ambition in the Eastern Pacific. The crowd was generous, vocal, and in great mood, but like Doreen, concerned.
Well, what's important is it's our country, our sovereignty, our freedom in our own country. We don't want communists come into our country. And for our passport, we don't want to lose that privilege from New Zealand. New Zealand being our brother, our big brother, that protected us over the years and still protecting us. You know, we don't want to lose those.
Standing on the steps of Parliament, opposition leader Tina Brown had a twofold message for the government.
We want to indicate our support for our passport to remain forever. And secondly, we have great concerns around the approach taken by government with the agreement with China.
When you look around your fellow Cook Islanders here today, are you heartened by what you see in terms of the message?
Absolutely, absolutely. There is no doubt that about what the public wants. Yeah.
The leader of the opposition Cook Island United Party, Terekia Heather, tapping into that broad concern had prompted a vote of no confidence in the government, but he also cites other factors at play.
It's not about the numbers, it's about their conviction in their hearts. What do they feel? And the people have spoken well today. Because of the China deal, New Zealand has came out very strong. Whatever happens with the Chinese, that's what why we march here today. Not only for our passport, our relationship, but this is, you know, not consulting the people of the Cook Islands. This is very serious for us.
So where to from here then? What pressure can you put on the Prime Minister and his government?
Well, there's a motion of no confidence in his cabinet and himself, and that's to be forthcoming.
You look at the bottom line of the budget here, though, in the Cook Islands. I mean, the numbers aren't particularly flash. You can see why China might be an attractive proposition.
Well, again, it's a relationship I'd rather have more important than the money that we're asking for.
And for protest organiser Jackie Turawa, taking the message to the government is so much more than just the money.
For our future, for my children's future, for the safety of this country, and also for the fact that government just has not been hearing our voices. We've stood before for many other important issues, and our voices have not been heard. So we're standing again today to show our people, to show New Zealand that this passport, our connection to New Zealand, is so valuable to us, and not just politically, but also our connection to the Ititata or Aotearoa, New Zealand Māori, Cook Island Māori. Our history tells us that we are one, that they left our shores for Aotearoa. Ko mātou te tuakana, ko rātou te tēnā. And so that relationship too is extremely important. And what other country is there better to be connected with? I don't see any.
I can see and feel the emotion in your heart.
Yeah, definitely. It's a concern when our government is not listening to our cries. It's a concern that they are not transparent. It's a concern when they say one thing but do another. It's a concern when they hold consultations but have pre-decided agendas. So the consultations are just a tick to say they've consulted, but they are not listening to what we are saying. They are not hearing our concerns.
How can you bring pressure on this government? They have a mandate until next year. They have a healthy majority in Parliament.
I really don't know, because I'm not a politician. I'm just a mother concerned for my children and the people of this country.
You don't then have confidence in your Prime Minister?
No, I don't. At this stage, I definitely don't have confidence in our Prime Minister.
Do you think the motion of no confidence is going to work?
I hope it does.
Can members of the CIP come across and support that motion?
I hope they do. Definitely. And I think if this government ignores those emotions, then they definitely need to go.
And that is protest organiser Jackie Turua ending that report from Brendan Telfer in Rarotonga. Meanwhile, opposition MP and leader of the Cook Islands United Party, Te Ariki Heather, was one of the leaders of yesterday's protest march. He told the ABC's Whenau Whanua that he was disappointed Prime Minister Mark Brown did not meet or face up to the protest march.
We expected for him to be there and to hear the people of the Cook Islands. That's the reason for the march, to tell him, please sincerely apologise to the people of the Cook Islands and more so to the New Zealand government for what he has done. And that's the Cook Island way. But he wasn't there to receive us in that sense. So, and also we were prepared to give him a response, respond from him regarding all the speakers that was present there today. But he wasn't there. So, you know, what's the point in talking to any other minister? He's the head of the country.
The motion of no confidence, when is he going to face that motion?
Well, already I've tabled today, according to proceedings of Parliament, and it sits there for 14 days because I sent in that, according to the standing orders last week, the 11th of February. So by the 14th, by the 25th next week, that's 14 days. But the appropriation bill takes precedent. So after that appropriation, the budget for the country, our supply, then I'll be able to move that motion and talk to the motion about that one and see. If it doesn't sort of go through, then it's not a problem. At least it's been put there after the protest or before the protest to see. New Zealand really is the one that we're seeking, pleading, to reconsider our position. Whatever, the China deal, signing, whatever that is, please reconsider our position as Cook Islanders, our relationship.
So you're worried that this would have repercussions, that New Zealand may review or relook its relationship with the Cook Islands?
Yes, that's my serious concern. Because New Zealand has come back and waiting upon whatever has been signed, because they've never been consulted again as good partners for 60 years. They've never been consulted in what is being signed. So our Prime Minister is a bit of secrecy, and that's the reason why we had to march before that outcome comes in. We don't even know what it is, whether it's benefit us, our relationship with New Zealand again. That's a concern and worry for us.
What about the seabed mining? What's your position on that?
We protested against that for the simple reason they haven't, no scientific evidence has been, said it's okay. But we want some confirmation that it doesn't impact seriously on our ocean life. And that, again, we're most seriously concerned about that. It's not about the wealth from the ocean that will benefit us, more so the ocean, what gives us, you know, daily life. We lived and enjoyed that for the last 100 years or so. So that's our stance on that one, is we're totally against the seabed mining for now. But until we get real scientific evidence that it was sort of like repair itself, but not at this time.
When did you know that Mark Brown was going to China to sign an agreement? Was it out of the blue? Did he consult any of you or anyone outside of his cabinet?
Well, he didn't really consult everybody, but it was at the last minute they said he's off to China, which New Zealand knew already he was off to China. And that's the reason why we pick up that media from New Zealand. So he left, telling the whole country he was about to leave that afternoon, Friday afternoon. So he came back yesterday.
And that's the leader of the Cook Islands United Party, Te Ariki Heather. And by late yesterday afternoon, Cook Islands Prime Minister Mark Brown released details of the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership document with China. The ABC's Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts took a look at the document and shared his thoughts about it with Girish Shalwani.
Look, we know a little bit more now, Girish. The Cook Islands government's released what it's called the action plan for its strategic partnership with China. This is a bit of a broad, overarching document that describes in broad terms exactly what the two countries would like to do together, although it doesn't get down into specifics. Now, most of this document would read as a pretty innocuous one. There's a lot of talk about cooperation in things like culture and energy, renewable energy, but there are a few things that will probably catch the eye of strategists and analysts in both Wellington and elsewhere. In particular, a reference in the document to setting up consular missions in both countries, suggesting that China might like Cook Islands to set up some sort of representative office in China, and that it might look at doing the same, setting up a mission in Cook Islands, in Rarotonga, rather than relying on its High Commission, its embassy rather, in Wellington, as well as surprisingly, discussions about the importance of cooperation on joint transport and also on potentially working together on deep sea mining and mineral exploration. Now, what isn't included are some of the other documents which were also signed during Mark Brown's visit to China and which are potentially likely to cause quite a bit of anxiety in New Zealand. And we saw a statement from a spokesperson this afternoon from Winston Peters, the Foreign Minister of New Zealand, saying they welcome this document, this overarching document being made public, but they still want the government of Cook Islands to release and make public the other more detailed agreements as soon as possible. And they say it's only when those documents have been released that they can make a full assessment of exactly the scope of the cooperation that's being considered and what that might mean for the relationship and for New Zealand's security, as well as regional security more broadly. So, yes, this is definitely a win for transparency that this document is out there, but New Zealand is saying it's only a first step and it's demanding full transparency from Mark Brown to put all of the other documents, particularly the ones you suspect that might touch on things like seabed exploration, deep sea mining, potential cooperation on maritime infrastructure and the like. So those topics with potential security implications, New Zealand wants those documents out in the public as well.
And that's ABC's Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts speaking to ABC's Girish Salwani.
Pacific Beat.
A Papua New Guinea human rights activist has called on citizens of the country to take stock and reflect on the brutal deaths of two women over the past week. Lena Nambalihi was allegedly killed by her partner at a military barracks, while Margaret Gamaru Gabriel was allegedly kidnapped, raped and murdered last weekend. Human rights advocate Ruth Kissam says it's worrying that no official arrests have been made and justice has not been served.
For the last 2 to 3 years or so, we've been talking about how the increased level of crimes that are going unpunished is one day going to turn around and bite us. And that's exactly what is happening. A lot of the crimes that are being committed, they're committed with impunity because they know that no one's going to actually hold them accountable. And that's what our problem is. People are not animals that they can just do this and would think that there's no consequence. The problem we have is that there is no consequence for crimes that are being committed. So, of course, people are going to go around and do all of this because they know that they can do it and get away with it. And that's where our problem is. Now, to talk about the systems that we have in place, I think, you know, a lot has been done to make sure that the police, the numbers are more, the ratio of the police is more acceptable. A lot has been done to make resources available. A lot has been done for even for Parliament to have a committee on gender-based violence. So different state entities will be held accountable to bring to not only for arrest to be made, but prosecution done so it can lead up to convictions. That's the thing that we are not following through. We've got some of the best laws in our country, and those laws just need implementation. But our problem right now is that we are not enforcing those laws.
When we talk about what has happened at, especially to do with late Lena at the where her body was actually brought to the Port Moresby General Hospital, and her partner, or the father of her two children, who is allegedly still, we have not known of her location. Even police have said they found him, and this is a second death within the Murray Barracks area. What is your biggest concern about this?
This is in the city, but imagine up in the Highlands and on the islands where policemen might be less than 20, say, in one province, or maybe less than 40 in one province, and that province might have 200,000 people. Imagine what they're going to be thinking. They can do whatever they want to do because who's going to hold them accountable? That's the kind of attitude that people have. That's why they're going around breaking the laws, because no one's going to hold them accountable. And that's where most of our challenges are. Now, when it comes to Lena's killer, he's out there. He's getting online. He's posting about it. What is NICTA doing about it? How is NICTA working with the CID? How are the CID going around, the ones that are investigating their deaths, are going around trying to collect those kind of information when we're not even going after those killers, making them pay for their crimes, allowing them to get away? There's some amazing policemen that we have that are putting their lives on the line, going out, making sure they close off on a case that they're investigating on. But then there's been so many instances where we've not been able to do that. And that's why we have people that are copycatting, you know, on this.
From your perspective and from what has been happening, it's not the first. It's just happened again to be another trend that's just cropped up again in the last couple of days. But what needs to be done, Ruth?
I think this is a serious call to us as a nation. While we want the state to be held accountable, the state mechanisms to be held accountable, and I think they should be, this is also a question back to us as people. I mean, 20 men, whether or not they're all from Tapini, I don't think the investigation was able to verify. But for the young woman that was taken out of her home, raped and then killed and mutilated, birth canal mutilated, but it was done by 20 young men. What is that telling us as a society? I mean, I wish we had one that you can just wave it to tell us, okay, this is the key problem. But it's not. I think it's an all nationwide issue when you're looking at a group of young men just ganging up to go in, rob a house, but then decide to take a young woman captive and then mutilate her. It talks about a country without values.
And that is human rights advocate Ruth Kissam speaking there to ABC's Belinda Cora.
Join me, Melissa Makin, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
At the Wai Wallo, thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. We head to the US now, where Donald Trump's immigration crackdown promises to deport millions of illegal or migrant criminals back to their country of heritage. For Pacific people in the diaspora, there's fear that people without updated documentation or those convicted of low-end or petty crimes might be sent away from their families. Even people in the US living under special immigration arrangements, such as those from Palau, the Marshall Islands, might be at risk. To find out more, Carl Evans spoke to Papali'i Manumalo, a Pacific community leader in the California area.
I think executive orders are just very overwhelming. It's caught some folks. They're literally in shock that it's moving so quickly. I think what was published late last year in November, there was a docket that came out of ICE, and it basically had the number of deportees for each of the island groups and actually any country in the world. I think a lot of us honed in on, you know, Fiji, Samoa, Tonga, you know, Federated States of Micronesia. And that was published back in November of 2024. The Biden administration was probably very lax in actually enforcing it. So when January came around and we started to see a lot of the populations being detained for deportation, I think that shook up a lot of fear. And for folks who supported Trump's administration, confusion and shock.
Yeah, I guess one of the things we're trying to figure out is what has changed under Trump compared to Biden, because I know that there were a lot of deportations under Biden as well. Have you seen a notable difference on the ground since Trump's inauguration?
Yeah, there's been some reports in Utah, here in California, of ICE officers coming around places of worship and places of employment, as well as outside of schools for our community members who would have been impacted by, you know, their expiration date of a visa and or just not having proper documentation. So I think for them, it's that realization like, oh, wait, this is for real? This is happening? Yeah, it's happening.
So I guess the big difference is, I suppose, while, I mean, it's hard to say if the laws have changed too much. It was, like I said, there were a lot of deportees under Biden, but it definitely feels like it's being enforced more. Is that the key takeaway?
Yeah, it did not get as much media coverage back in November when it was published. But, you know, as far as the concern, yeah, people are fearful. Some people didn't even have their kids go to school. Some people didn't even go to work because they were afraid that they'll be met by ICE officers and be deported.
Are there many Pacific Islanders living in the sort of the Western States area that are undocumented, that could be in danger?
Yes. So I live in Southern California, right outside the LA area. So LA, San Francisco, in California, there's a large population of Pacific Islanders. And then there's a good number of folks that are also potentially overstayers who haven't been current with their documentation or their visas, whether it was through school or for work that brought them here. I don't know what the circumstances are for why certain people haven't had their documents made to be current or updated, but they are here. Several of them are our family members, and several of our family members actually supported Trump. And I just think for people to have anxiety and wanting to come to a country like the United States, you know, that promises refuge and opportunity for many people, I could see how it could be very, very frightful and scary for people to remain here because of how, like I said, how swiftly these executive orders have been just coming down almost daily. But, you know, there's other executive orders that impact Pacific Islanders, too. Just recently, there was an executive order to reduce the number of federal employees. There's a lot of civil servants that are Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders. People that might have their Medicare taken away from them or reduced.
And that's Pacific Community Leader in the California area, Papali Imanualo, speaking with Carl Evans. Good morning. We are at that point where we head around the region to get the latest headlines brought to you by our producer, Finau Fonua, who's in the studio with me this morning. Good morning,
Fefe. Good morning, Agnes. I'm fine. Thank you, Save.
All right. We are back at it. We have been talking a lot about deportations. Looks like New Zealand is joining that, where the immigration authorities are now under fire for a decision to deport an epileptic teenager to Fiji. What's the latest details on that, Finau?
Fiji Times reports the Immigration and Protection Tribunal of New Zealand has ruled a 15-year-old Fijian boy who has epilepsy and developmental delays is being deported from New Zealand. New Zealand Herald reports immigration authorities had determined the teenager cannot stay, citing potential strain on the country's special education resources. So when people move to New Zealand and apply for visas, the New Zealand immigration authorities vet them, and if they find that they have an illness or some kind of disability,
they don't want an automatic strike against you.
Yeah, it's an automatic strike. It's been a controversial issue in New Zealand. Mm. The family, they've been allowed to stay, but they've stated that if their boy gets sent back to Fiji, they would have to accompany him. The teen has been granted a 6-month visitor visa, but it expires in May.
Okay, well, obviously it's a developing story, so we'll keep our eyes and ears on that one. Now to some sports news, though. Pacific Oz Series enters its second day. Now, I know, Finau, you've been watching the highlights. How are the results looking?
Most of the games have been hotly contested. It's been an exciting competition. Interestingly, Tonga's Dala, they've suffered 2 upset defeats. 1 to First Nations Australia, who they lost to 56-58. The other 2 Samoas, Tifa Moana, who they narrowly lost to 55-52. So definitely disappointing to Tongan fans because Tala were the favorites. Mm. They're 4th place out of 6. So Tala still have a possible chance of getting through to the finals if they win all of their next games convincingly. And if the 2 3 teams above them lose games. Right. Tifa Moana have been doing well. They won their opener against Fiji Pearls as well, 54-45. Yeah. Fiji's Pearls have struggled. They suffered another big defeat to Scotland, 67-47 in their opener. Papua New Guinea have also lost both of their games to Scotland and First Nations. The teams which have been dominating the comp are Scotland and First Nations Australia. So there's a real danger that we may see a non-Pacific Islander final. Something to note, yep. Marke Babia for First Nations Australia, she's the first Torres Strait Islander to play for that team.
Mm. Well done to you, Markia. Look, all across with all the Pacific nations, I'm not going to lie, I'm happy that Samoa is in there. Beat Tonga. let's head to some other news. I believe refugee advocates, this is quite serious, they're going to launch an urgent legal challenge to stop Australia's Nauru deportation deal. What's happening there?
Yes, this was expected. Asylum seeker advocates are scrambling to launch an urgent legal action against the federal government as it prepares to deport 3 non-citizens to Nauru. On Sunday, Australia Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke announced the small Pacific nation had agreed to issue long-term resettlement visas to the former immigration detainees who were among the so-called NZYQ cohorts released into the community after the High Court ruled indefinite immigration detention was illegal. Burke said all 3 were violent offenders and would be sent as soon as agreements are made. But Asylum Seeker Resource Centre has told SBS News that they will launch a legal challenge as a matter of urgency.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm hoping that we can actually get someone from, you know, the Asylum Seeker Resource to come and talk to us to see how this is going to plan out. But Finel, always great to have you come through and share the latest headlines from around the Pacific region. If you're just joining us, that is our producer Finel Funua with your news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sportspeople to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Vi Nakavakalevu, welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to sport now. The organisers are describing it as a cricket event where the game's global reach will be celebrated like never before. Three teams representing Europe, Britain, Ireland and Asia, together with the rest of the world 11, will compete in a T10 tournament over 5 days in the Spanish resort city of Malaga. The rest of the world team will be captained by former New Zealand great Ross Taylor, and the side will also feature a leg spin bowler from Vanuatu's national squad, William Singh Nalisa. He's been playing club cricket in Melbourne in recent months and was shocked and surprised to receive a call-up. William Singh says he only arrived in Spain 48 hours before his first match, which starts later today, and he finds himself in a lineup that includes several Australian players who have featured in past editions of the national T20 competition.
I got to meet James Basley, who's in the Big Bash, and a few of the other blokes who played in Big Bash, and a bloke from Scotland, and literally just met them yesterday, and we haven't had much of the time to catch up, but I got to see Ross Taylor yesterday, and he asked me you know, some questions about, you know, where I'm from, and we'll have more of a catch-up and, you know, talk about cricket or the upcoming tournament, yeah.
Clearly, you're flying the flag for Vanuatu over there as part of this international team in an international competition, but I think it's fair to say you're flying the flag for the whole Pacific, because I don't think there are any other islanders in the squad, are there?
Yeah, apart from Ross Taylor being, I think, half someone or something, but yeah, but representing my country in this world stage, it's an honorable thing for me, you know. As a kid growing up, you dream of getting into a World Cup and playing for your country in a World Cup, and I think for me this is the closest to be playing in a World Cup, and it's an amazing opportunity, and I can't wait for the experience. Yeah, so I'm stoked, and I'm glad to represent my country here, fly my flag here, and yeah, represent my family and the club I'm playing for. It's an amazing opportunity, and I can't wait to get into it.
T10 cricket, it's 10 overs a side, so it's even quicker than T20, obviously, by 50%. Do you have much experience of playing T10 cricket, or will this be the first time?
In Vanuatu, I think Shane Deeds, our former coach, he organised one of a T10 blast, and yeah, I got a taste of that, but internationally, I've never had any experience with T10 whatsoever. I think it's fast, and I don't know what to expect, but I think I'm well prepared for it, and yeah, I'm up for the challenge.
And the fact that you're playing alongside players who have experience of playing in the Big Bash here in Australia, and obviously Ross Taylor, an outstanding record in international cricket at all levels, from T20 to test matches for New Zealand. I mean, if you can impress in this tournament, that the word will find its way back to New Zealand and to Australia. And who knows, you might find yourself playing in the Big Bash or the Smash over in New Zealand one day.
Yeah, that's the big dream. You know, this has got to be a start to more to come. I'm hoping that I'll impress and hopefully get picked for future or upcoming tournament. I don't know what the future holds, but I think this is a start to what's to come. And I told my teammates back in Melbourne, these guys are going to have sore years with this tournament, because I'll be asking a lot of questions about, you know, playing top level cricket, and what I learned from them, I think it'll help my career. So yeah, I'll be asking a lot of questions, and hopefully I get to, you know, learn a lot of things, and I can use it to get to that top level. Yeah.
What's the weather like there in Spain? Sunny, I hope.
Yeah, it's sunny, and it's supposed to be sunny the whole week. So yeah, I got a bit of a walk around yesterday, and yeah, head down to the beach. I think it's pretty similar to home, which is perfect. Being from a Pacific island, you know, you grew up around sea, so beach. So yeah, I got to walk around and have a watch the sunset yesterday. It's quite nice, and it's lovely here. I'm loving it.
And that is Vanuatu national team cricketer William Singh Nalisa talking to Richard Hewitt on the line from Malaga.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
To agricultural news now, Papua New Guinea will this week join the Council of Palm Oil Nations as its fourth member. Council members from Indonesia, Malaysia and Thailand are in Port Moresby to go through the final phase of entry before accepting PNG's membership. Secretary General for PNG Oil Palm Industry, Kepson Pupita, says a kina $3 billion in revenue goes right back to farmers and supports sustainable projects.
It's a organized, comprised of countries basically growing and producing palm oil. And this organization is founded by Malaysia and Indonesia, the biggest palm oil producing countries. Indonesia with well over 20 million hectares of planted palm oil, and Malaysia with over 5.6 million hectares of palm oil plantations. And so PNG has been trying to become a member since 2018, and eventually last year, November, the Papua New Guinea Parliament has given the okay. Both sides of the government have fully agreed for Papua New Guinea to become a member to this international organization, formally endorsed by the Council of Ministries of the member countries of Malaysia, Indonesia, and Honduras. So they are basically to facilitate the final phase of Papua New Guinea become the fourth country to be a member to this organization. And at the same time, they are here to see Papua New Guinea's current status as a palm oil producing country. You know, the egg rates of palm oil planted here, which areas we have planted the palm oil, the number of growers, if we have small or less participating in the business, and the number of private investors investing in the palm oil sector in the country.
Talking about sustainability, I want to talk about oil palm and deforestation in various provinces that oil palms are being grown. What can you tell us about this?
Papua New Guinea is number one in producing sustainable palm oil. Since the oil palm was introduced in PNG in 1968 by New Britain Palm Oil and Hagi Oil Palm Limited of Belgium, we have been producing palm oil sustainably, and we have been exporting 100% of that palm oil to Europe. Mainly to Amsterdam and Rotterdam. And we've had a track record of producing palm oil sustainably, and we've met 100% the international oil palm standard, which we call the RSPO.
So how many hectares do we already have where oil palm is already growing, apart from these hectares that you're talking about?
We have around about 100% compliant plantation. It's around about almost 200,000. The compliant the oil palm that got developed in the 60s and 70s. The current one under the ICBL is around about 30,000 hectares. So we are talking about only 230,000 hectares of planted palm oil in PNG. Very, very small compared to Malaysia, Indonesia.
What are the benefits? How many families are being supported or assisted by these benefits?
We have around about 21,000 smaller blocks, benefiting around about almost 100,000 families. In those smallholder blocks. That's basically smallholders alone. And together with the milling companies, we have almost around about 400,000 or 500,000 families and PNG citizens employed in this industry. And it's one of the biggest industry, both in comparison to any one single sector in the non-renewable and renewable.
And that was Secretary General for PNG Oil Palm Industry talking to reporter Godwin Eke. Now, it's been referred to as the silent killer and linked to over 100 deaths in children under 5 years old every day across the Asia-Pacific region. A new UNICEF report reveals the staggering impacts of toxic air on millions of children and are urging immediate action to protect their health and future. I got to speak to Nicholas Rees, Program Manager for Climate and Environment for UNICEF's East Asia and Pacific region earlier, and he says the numbers are terrifying.
It's really just the sheer numbers of children affected. About 100
children dying a day in this region due to air pollution-linked causes. I mean, I think that that number is just terrifying. And the causes of air pollution are multitude as well. We've got fossil fuel combustion, burning of agricultural waste, but also it's indoor household air pollution that is responsible for a lot of these deaths too. It's just the sheer number of children affected. About 1 in 4 child deaths in the region is linked with air pollution, making it the second leading risk factor for child mortality. And these aren't just statistics. These are children's lives, children's futures effectively being stolen due to the air that they breathe.
And you just touched on it, which maybe to most of us, when we hear about household air pollution, could you explain that a little bit further as to the cause of death for young children?
Sure. So about 35 million children live in countries where, in this region, where household air pollution is particularly high. Household air pollution is caused by burning of solid fuels for cooking, heating, and often there's just improper ventilation in the house. So these are very fixable problems. Children learn, play around the kitchen with their parents, and it's the exposure indoors that is responsible for about half of the death. And even though outdoor air pollution is often touted as being the thing that a lot of people are aware of that makes media headlines, but the indoor air pollution is something that we're tremendously worried about.
The threat of toxic air pollution, is it then more prone to certain communities in the Pacific region?
So, and this is where we see household air pollution particularly high in some islands. Solomon Islands, for example, has high levels of indoor air pollution. Papua New Guinea also, due to improper burning, unclean cook stoves. The indoor air pollution, it's linked with pneumonia, bronchitis, asthma. About half of pneumonia cases, for example, are linked with air pollution.
Are you saying that children are just more prone because of their young age?
Yeah, their lungs are growing, their bodies are growing and developing, and this makes them particularly vulnerable at this early stage in life. In fact, the vast majority of the mortality that we see in children is actually within the first year, and even a huge portion of that is within the first month after birth.
What about climate change? How much does that sort of play into this?
So these are obviously very linked things, but they're not exactly the same. And we've seen the growth of fossil fuels, then air pollution spiked in major cities across the region.
Reality, if people were to just ask, they'd want to know, what do we need to do? What levels does our air quality have to be at in order to prevent these deadly impacts?
Well, what's scary is how high the levels of air pollution are across the region. And it's not every single country, but across the whole of the East Asia and Pacific region, we see about 2/3 of kids living in countries where air pollution is 5 times what is considered safe, according to the WHO. Just improving the awareness of parents, of teachers, of caregivers, and how to better adjust behavior to reduce exposure, I think can go a really long way. But also, obviously, in the policy space, having very clear policies on actions to reduce fossil fuel combustion and supporting that clean energy transition can make a big difference, too, to not just reduce air pollution, but reduce children's exposure to it.
When children are sick, that means days off school, long-term illness. What are the impacts it has on either the education sector or even the health sector itself?
The impacts of air pollution, often talk about it's a health impact, but it's also a learning impact. And as such, it affects a multitude of children's rights and children's needs. It's important to say that air pollution really just does affect so much of a child's overall well-being.
What's the economic fallout from this?
Well, very, very large. The report covers in some detail the range of potential economic effects. Just in this region, it's estimated to result in about $2.5 trillion in economic loss. And that's why we call it a silent disruptor. And it costs economies billions.
And that's Nicholas Rees, Program Manager for Climate and Environment for UNICEF's East Asia and Pacific region. That literally brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories. Cook Islands government has revealed its action plan with China. Opposition leader Te Ariki Brown says its secrecy and absence of consultation is threatening foreign relations with New Zealand.
As good partners for 60 years, they've never been consulted in what has been signed. So our Prime Minister is a bit of secrecy. need. And that's the reason why we had to march.
I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nita Daily. Till next time, o tō o whātou, this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.